Welcome again to Food Conversations, Season 5. Before we begin, of course, we once again acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Now today, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Mike Schroeder, owner-operator of Lakeland Farms, Inc., an organic farm located a few hundred meters beyond the end of Foothills Road in the Salmon River Valley. Mike and his wife Sarah and their two sons Eric and Lucas farm on 325 acres. By the way, I mentioned Lucas because he's in almost all the pictures, and I think he may be secretly running the farm. Roughly half of which they own and half of which is leased. There they grow a range of feed and forage crops, around 4,500 chickens, and run a small organic feed mill for themselves and for sales to other farmers. As you will learn, this is truly a family farm. Welcome, Mike, to Food Conversations.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's lovely to have you here because you really, even though you moved here in 2015, you've embedded yourself in the community in numerous ways. And I want to talk initially about your feed mill, because your feed mill was something that actually drew the attention of a number of people in the community, because you had to go to the Agricultural Land Commission and get permission to put a feed mill. They had sort of size limits and all that kind of stuff, and where you got your raw materials for the mill and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right.
So I came across a story in the Salmon Arm Observer dated April 16th, 2020. And it was about your feed mill and the process of getting established here. And I just read a few lines from it, and you can tell me what it was like for you. But here's what the article stated. First of all, it said that the Land Commission approval was necessary, and 50% of the broad use that you would be processing would be perhaps coming from off-site. And that was something that they had they got a toga in their twist a little bit. So it said, a plan to build a feed mill for Salmon Arm poultry operation received accolades from the Salmon Arm Council. This is a good news story, said Councillor Tim Lavery, who I know very well and is very progressive in his thinking. And the mayor had something to say as well. Alan Harrison said, I have a bit of a personal attachment to this property. I know it very well, and I am really pleased that it will be put to good use. And basically, the rest of the article talked about the size, 334 square meters of land would be taken up by this mill, and that it would be feeding your chickens, but also for other farmers in the area. And then this whole issue of how much you use that was grown on the farm came up. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't the beginning of the process of getting the feed mill. You'd been thinking about this for a while. What had brought you to thinking, we need a feed mill on our property?
I think it was the result of a long string of events, I guess. And so if it works, I'll go back to kind of when we got here. So we had the property and moved here in 2015, and had kind of decided to come back to agriculture. I grew up in agriculture, left for a while, decided to come back. We were starting our family. And we really kind of started with a piece of bare land. We had some buildings and a shop and stuff, but no equipment or anything like that. So we did a lot of research. We started in forage production, but quickly moved into got it certified organic and moved into grain production.
It was nearly certified when you bought it.
That's right. Yeah. Right. It had been in hay production for quite a while and hadn't had any chemical applications or synthetic, fertilizers or anything. So it was a pretty quick transition for us. And so we got into organic grain, and that was going to provide us with some opportunity at value added. And so we did a couple of years of that and applied for quota through the BCA New Producer Program, which we were awarded in 2018. So we built a poultry barn. And that gave us a little bit of diversity and some nutrients on the farm coming back, because that was a real challenge for us with crop production. Nutrients are really expensive. And I immediately
nutrients,
wanted...
Nutrients, by the way, that means chicken poop.
That's right, yeah.
Which is good stuff.
Very valuable stuff. Yeah. So I wanted to build... I knew right away, they were pushing us into organic, and we wanted to be organic anyway with the birds. And so it was obvious, like there was no organic feed produced in the interior at that time. Everything was being shipped from the lower mainland or out in Alberta. And so our feed would be coming, a lot of our feed would be coming out of Alberta as a raw ingredient, going right past us on the highway, all the way down to the lower mainland, getting milled and then shipped on another truck all the way back here. So we're talking about an extra 1,000 kilometers or
this is getting 800. Crazy. This is getting crazy.
And so it was a challenge, but also a big opportunity because we were producing the grain. We had the chickens. So the feed mill was an obvious choice. And I wanted to build it right away. Like I wanted to build the chicken barn and the feed mill at the same time. And the bank talked me out of it, which was really good, a really good thing.
And why was it a good thing?
Because I just didn't have the knowledge. Like I didn't have the connections in the community and in the industry. And I needed those first two or three years to get our feet under us with the birds and the egg production side. And it gave us a lot of time to do a lot of research as well. So we scaled the feed mill so that if we never sold any feed, we could still support it with our own production and everything. Mm-hmm. And then if guys got on board and would feed with us, because there was a bunch of producers in the same boat as us in the interior with organic production.
But your application must have included the possibility of grain from other sources, and that's what got the ALC excited.
That's right. Yeah. They didn't. So their rule, I think, was we needed to provide 50% of the ingredients ourselves from our own production land. And so if we were conventional, that maybe that would be simpler, simpler and safer. But with organics, our crop rotation is so important, and it changes so much year to year, depending on soil conditions and nutrients and disease and so on.
Weather.
And we didn't know what our demand was going to be. Like if everybody jumped on board with us, there's no way we could produce it all. And there's seasonal challenges with weather too. You know, we had the drought in 2021 and knocked out 40%, almost 50% of our production. So that's what ruffled their feathers. But honestly, that permit process and everything, aside from the paperwork end of things, was not that bad. It was pretty obviously a good idea, and we got a lot of support from the city and the community to do that project, and the ALC kind of checked the box, and away we went. Mm-hmm. So,
and the building of it, there's a lot of photographs on your website, and it's quite the production thing. These are not little tiny tin cans. These are large containers that have to be elevated and then dropped onto frames and that kind of stuff. What was that like, seeing this go up? You've been 3 or 4 years in, or even more, in the process of getting ready. It must have felt pretty cool.
Oh, that's cool. Frightening. You know, like, very frightening. But it was great. I've always had an interest in nutrition. I did quite a bit of nutrition work in school, and I knew, you know, I very early, it was obvious that soil health was the foundation of everything. But we could really affect our egg production and everybody else's egg production with the nutrition of the hens. And there was a lot of opportunity there too, to use, byproducts and unconventional feed products when we could find them, especially if we could produce them ourselves.
We're going to talk about fava beans.
Yeah, we will.
Because that's a really interesting story.
Yeah.
So you got it built. You went through your alternating feelings of terror and pride and delight.
Yeah.
And then the mill started operating, and things really changed as a result of having the mill, especially when the roads were knocked out.
Yeah. Well, we went through a cycle of events there. So we built it in 2020. We did 6 months of production just for ourselves, just to make sure that we weren't going to mess something up. Mm-hmm. And then we, in the spring of 2021, we commercialized the mill, separated the business into Lakeland Feeds Incorporated, and started servicing other farms. And we got really good uptake that spring and picked up a couple of farms and kind of quickly got up to about 20,000 birds, which isn't big, you know, if you looked at the average of the province, but for us, that was a big step. And in that spring is when the drought started of 2021. So the drought started, it was obvious that crop production was not going to be there. And then we went into forest fire season. So there was the chaos of that.
Double trouble.
Everybody knows about that. And so then ingredient costs doubled, like within a few months, and we had all these guys to service, and like they don't do well if you don't feed them, you know? And, so it was a really, it was a big stress on us. So we went through that. And then November, 2021, the highways got knocked out, which was, this project was meant to be. Like, if the highways had got knocked out and we were still trying to bring feed from the lower mainland, it would have been really messy. And we ended up feeding all of the commercial sized organic poultry guys, you know, in the interior and in the Kootenays, but through that period.
So that gave you a huge boost.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the few operations that prospered during a time that really was very hard on just about everybody.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't easy for us through that period. But we were fortunate because when we built the feed mill, we also built a bunch of storage on site there. So we had already, because of the drought, and it was obvious that there, by the time we got all the way around to like spring, summer of 2022, there was going to be no grain left, you know? So we bought everything that we could afford to hold. And so through 21, through the highway washout, we had months of ingredients. So that was a real strength for us.
You were well situated.
Yeah, it was very fortunate. And then, so we, you know, finished, the highways got put back together and things kind of normalized a little bit. And then in the spring of 22, avian flu started in the interior here. Like, you could see it marching across North America from the east. It got to the interior here. Everything got shut down. Biosecurity went to full.
Right up the.
Yeah. And so that was a big stress too. And then that fall, November 2022, then avian flu hit the coast and decimated poultry production at the coast. If our feed had been coming from there, we would have been bringing in trucks with potential contamination, et cetera, et cetera. So it really was meant to be for us to have that
project. It's the right project at the right time. I remind listeners again that I'm talking to Mike Schroeder, who is the owner-operator of Lakeland Farms, Inc., which is an organic farm in the Salmon River Valley. So that was a venture that you didn't plan on being what it turned out to be, but you knew in your heart of hearts that it would be really nice to have production from your own land and in your own area. You said when you started looking into the organic grains and organic feeds, there weren't any suppliers in BC, or at least this part of BC. Are there other people now doing it besides you?
There's one guy in Armstrong that's got an organic feed mill as well, and he caters more to the retail side, like so smaller bag feed and that. Yeah.
So that's the only one in the whole of the province?
No, he's just in the interior. Okay. So there is some big mills at the coast that produce organic feed.
What about producing organic grains for feed? How many operations would there be now in British Columbia?
Oh, I probably couldn't put an accurate number on it. It's not big. I mean,
no.
Our land base is pretty small compared to a place like Alberta. Like, for sure, a lot of the production, the grain production, comes from Alberta.
Yeah, I certainly know people who've talked to regulatory authorities about the fact that they're doing organic growing of one sort or another, and the people who sort of oversee the agricultural world in BC don't seem to recognize that there's something unique about organic growing and the products of organic growing. Do you find that you have to explain things to people, or do you find that the people that come to you say, we're coming to you because you're organic?
Yeah, I think definitely because we're organic, like they have the knowledge of what it is and that, for sure.
They're on board.
Yeah, they're on board already.
Just one other question about the feed mill. Did you ever buy feed stock for your feed mill off farm, or did it end up always being your own stuff that you were processing?
We buy off farm. There's some ingredients that we can't produce here.
But obviously you fell well within the guidelines of the Agricultural Land Commission.
Yeah.
So they could relax.
Oh, yeah.
And you could relax because they were relaxed.
Yeah, that's right.
So your background is in farming. In the Abbotsford area, your parents had a dairy farm. Mm-hmm. And you worked and played on the dairy farm. What was that like being a farm kid for you?
Well, it was just fun. It was just straight up fun. When you're a kid on a farm, you're free of all the the business side, the management side, the economics and all that stuff. It's
and
just
the space limitations.
Yeah.
You can only play over here. You can't play over there.
Well, that's right. We lived, we had a, it was 250 acres at the end of a dead end road. So we had the whole end of the road and we could go where we wanted. So I grew up with two other cousins that were my age and a younger brother. And the four of us were all over the farm all the time. So we had quads and paintball guns and we had horses and bikes and you name it. And, but we also had the responsibility that everybody kind of knows farm kids get, you know, you don't get a choice, you inherit that. And, so we had chores. We had, I remember a lot of summers of, you know, we worked all summer long. We, probably the fondest memory for sure is making hay down there. Like my grandfather, loved making small square bales.
Yes. You mentioned know, he was a small square guy.
He loved it. He loved to sit on the baler. You know, he would, when I was a kid, he would have been in his mid 60s and into his 70s. And, so he would be the baler guy. And then we had to pick up the bales and it was pretty regular. 15,000 bales a summer was a pretty regular number. And so they had to be handled twice, once off the field, once into the barn or three times, and then once out to the cows. And so, but we really enjoyed it. We spent a lot of summers making hay down there.
Making hay.
Yeah, that's right.
In the literal sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever tell your grandfather that maybe he could do some bigger ones, like yeah. those roll-up things?
Yeah, yeah. Well, nobody was really excited to fix the baler when it broke down. It wasn't bad to get the custom guy in
to get fixed.
Yeah, get some big squares made.
Now, your wife, Sarah, also has a background in farming, different kind of background, hobby mm-hmm. farm, 4-H. What yeah. was her sort of forte? What was her interest and strength in that area?
She well, she's a teacher by trade, so she, and she's a very happy, very social person. So she got a hold of 4-H when she was younger and loved it, loved the animals, but really loved the people, and stuck with 4-H until they kicked her out, you know. And
How old are you allowed to stay in 4-H before you're offloaded?
I want to say it's 19.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah, she really enjoyed it and made some great connections that she's still in touch with and people that have actually moved from there to this community. That and like we're going to have a strong 4-H club here in the next couple years. I was saying yesterday that when we were talking that the Salmon Valley, like when we had our kids and my oldest son's 7, youngest is 3. When we had our kids, there was a rash of kids born in the Salmon Valley on the farms. So there's going to be a
very fertile valley.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
They were growing like that.
Yeah.
So you didn't move to Salmon Arm, you know, obviously there was an interlude when you kind of wandered around the face of the earth looking at this, doing that. What sort of stuff did you do when you were exploring the world off the farm?
I did a bunch of stuff, a bunch more farm stuff, I guess. I worked in the layer industry, which got me interested in eggs. Worked with beef, a couple of other dairies and so on. And I also, I got a job started as a wrangler and then a guide and then an outfitter in the hunting industry. And that kind of took me all over the world.
And, all over the world. How far did you wander?
The weirdest place was Iran. I spent a month in Iran, in Kyrgyzstan, Africa, New Zealand.
So. And what took you? You have to tell our listeners, what took you to Iran?
It was hunting. I worked for, I ran an outfitting territory for a fellow that had a TV show on the Outdoor Channel, mostly in the States, Wild TV, I guess, for Canada. Hmm. But he traveled all over the world, and I became his cameraman for a little while, once off and on. And so he had, he wanted to go to Iran for some specific animals that he wanted to hunt and to do a film there, and nobody would go with him. And I was young at the time, and I needed to do something to prove myself, you know. And so I said, if I put up my hand and said, well, I'll go. And that was quite an experience.
That was the beginning of the next step of your life.
Yeah.
And you survived.
Yeah, we survived. We came back. Yeah, it was an eye-opener, though.
Yes, you saw a different way of living.
Yeah.
Then you kind of drifted off towards educational stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to, I guess in that period, I went back to school. I went to Alberta to Vermilion College, and I took an animal science diploma. Mm-hmm. Was really interested. I thought I wanted to be a vet at one point. I was really interested in nutrition. animal nutrition, and a couple other things. So I did that diploma, and then I went to the University of Edmonton, or University of Alberta in Edmonton, and kind of lost my drive for school, and really realized by the end of the first semester, realized that I was in the city, and I realized I didn't want to be a profession with like a service professional within agriculture. I wanted to be a primary producer. I wanted to be at ground level, and I wanted to be able to affect food production.
So you were actually taking like what would have been a full like 3 or 4 years or something like that would have kept you in school for a long time.
Yeah, and I would have ended up with a degree and then would have gotten vet medicine or something like that. So, but I ended up, I quit after that first semester at the university. I went back to the college and I took an agricultural business diploma and which was hugely valuable.
What was most important about it?
Well, I had a course that was a project-based course around writing a business plan. And so we were supposed to write a business plan for our dream farm. And so I had matured at that point. And
you had matured?
Because I'd been out of school and all that stuff, and I knew what I wanted.
Yeah.
You know, I had a really good direction. And so I dove into that business planning course and wrote up a pretty big business plan. And that helped me through everything that we've done now.
What was your dream farm at that time?
Well, it was a dairy farm at that time. So I designed a full dairy farm based around a property in the interior because there wasn't a lot of opportunity to fire up and, you know, down at the coast in an economical way. So
meaning the land is really expensive.
Very. Yeah. Yeah. So, so I built that around a dairy farm, and that was the idea when we bought the property up here in Salmon Arm. That was the original idea, and that kind of fell apart, and then we had to rethink things. And
that was in 2005. Your mom and dad bought the property then?
Yeah, bought the first piece.
And they were going to have a dairy farm. Yeah. What made it seem not the right thing to do?
The family succession stuff. You know, we couldn't find a situation that would work for everybody.
Yeah.
And so we ended up kind of starting on our own up here. And the family still has the farm down there. We still have a really good relationship and everything. Mm-hmm. There needed to be some separation there. So
right. Yeah. It's well known these days that many people that come from farming families do not go on to a farming, to continue the farming tradition. What do you think made it work for you? Because you have done it, and not only done it, but done it very successfully. What made this transition from growing up on a farm to running your own farm so meaningful for you?
I would probably say my parents and my wife. Mm-hmm. They have all been extremely supportive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you had a team, so it wasn't just one person doing it on your own.
Yeah.
Well, that's a wonderful thing. I think it's about time that it became possible for people from farming families to go back and work on the farm.
Yep.
Mention once again that I'm speaking today with Mike Schroeder, who is the owner-operator of Lakeland Farms in the Salmon River Valley, and a place that, as you'll hear, as you heard already, and you'll hear more, has done some really excellent things, especially bringing organic agriculture into sort of the mainstream of commercial farming. So you wrote your business plan, you had your ideal farm, it was going to be a dairy farm, but that's not what happened. The plan changed when you moved up here in 2015 and bought more land.
Mm-hmm.
And you told me that you weren't the highest bidders for the property, so there was something about you that the owner of the land made that tipped his hand in terms of investing in his land in you guys. Mm-hmm. What was that?
It was actually her land.
Her land?
Yeah. She.
Well, that's probably why she was really smart.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a rumor that I've heard. I don't know if that's actually true, but that we weren't the highest bidder. But
it's a good rumor.
Yeah, it makes me feel good.
Yes.
But we had a relationship with her because the first piece that we had originally bought was part of the same farm. And so we wanted to put the farm back together and get the other title. And that really made it kind of a viable, what looked like a viable farm for us to get up and get started, right. And be able to support a family and support a retirement for my parents and transition out of the farm. So I think that she just saw a farm family that wanted to keep going in the industry and kids that were interested, which I wouldn't say rare, but it's hard to find. It can be hard to find, I guess.
It is hard to find. Yeah. And we've, most of the people that have been interviewed on Food Conversations have been people who did not come from farming families. And if they did come from farming families, they ended up choosing something maybe related to food, but not farming.
Yeah.
So I think you are a bit of an exception. Mm-hmm. And obviously she could tell that that's what you had in mind.
Yeah.
So she had started it, the organic certification process. It wasn't quite complete. Mm-hmm. Did that have a hand in it, that she was farming organically and you thought that that would be a good way to go or something like that?
Yeah, because it was so close, it was an easy excuse for us to try it. And because the land was fairly clean, like it had been a hay farm for a long time, so weed pressure was pretty low. Soil quality was not great, and it's something that we've had to work really hard on the property, because it had been hayland without livestock for a while.
It was 160 acres, right?
Yeah, the original
piece. Which
is a
pretty big piece of property. Mm-hmm. And having been in hay for quite some time,
yeah,
it needed some work.
Yeah. Yeah, so we started with a lot of soil testing. We went into organic grain production so that we could kind of return a lot of residue back to the soil.
Because that involves rotational.
Yeah.
Plantings.
Yeah, and gave us the opportunity to do cover crops. So taking a lot less nutrients from the farm,
right.
Leaving more there, still getting good value for the products we were producing. And the cover crops was something I was really interested
in. And
were
the chickens there right from the beginning?
No, we built that, got the quota and built that.
So why don't you talk about getting an egg quota? Because that was quite a process.
Yeah,
begging and pleading.
It's hard to get into supply management, you know. It's really expensive to get into that business, and from the outside, without something to start with, the economics don't look great. And so we knew about the draw for a long the BC egg quota draw for a long time. So I had been putting in applications since 2010, and every time it would come up, I'd throw my application in, and we wouldn't get picked. It's a random draw. Like, as long as you get accepted, it's a random draw. So then in 2018, we had moved here. We had started farming with the crops. We knew if we wanted to accomplish all our goals, we needed something more. And so
you need chicken poop.
Yeah. That and
Yeah. Look, a lot of people, my father-in-law was a dairy farmer in the Fraser Valley, and I remember we got the big load of chicken manure.
Yeah.
And it sat there for a year because mm-hmm. it would have burned everything up if he'd put it on the fields, but made a huge difference.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does. And so we started the application 2017. I wrote a big business plan and had to get accepted. And
your next business plan.
Yeah, another business plan.
A real one this time.
Yeah, that's right.
So you don't start to indulge in chickens that lay eggs until you have an egg quota. So that was the rate-limiting step for this whole operation. What was it like when you finally got it? Did you get a letter in the mail or an email, or how did it come in?
We actually they hold a meeting and they do a draw, and it's all very public.
It's like the lotto.
It is totally. They actually have a spinner with the balls in it.
Oh Lord!
Yeah, and so you get a ball with a number on it, and if yours gets chosen, then you're in. So so Sarah and I went to the draw down in Abbotsford, sat in the room, they wound the thing around, and there was, I can't remember how many people got picked, but there was three for the interior and Vancouver Island.
And how many people would have been in this room sitting on the edge of their chairs wondering if it's going to be their day?
Probably like 100, between the existing producers and all these, you know, everybody that had applied, there's probably 150 people in there.
So is there a preference given to people who are starting up, or people who already have a quota? Can they get more and more quotas?
No. Okay. No, this is just for new producers, so you can't have any ties.
So these old egg farmers just sitting there to watch the fun.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, who's the new guy? Kind of. They want to know who the new guy is. So,
yeah. What a scene!
It was interesting, and like, it. I knew that if we got it, it's life changing for us.
Yes, you know. Well, that's when you could build a barn for the chickens.
Yeah, and we'd been trying for so long, so that when they drew our number, Sarah didn't realize it was ours, and I was just like, it caught my breath. I was like,
it happened. You couldn't breathe, and she didn't know.
Yeah, but they drew her name because we had both applied. So she actually owns the chickens.
Is that a trick?
And I work for
her. Is that a trick? Have your kids apply as well?
I wish we could have got the kids in there too. Yeah. So I work for her.
That's right. Well, yeah. that's how it is these days.
Yeah, that's right.
So when you when she realized that it was yours,
yeah.
What did you do? Jump up and down?
Oh yeah, jumped up and down. Then you know she went up and shook everybody's hand, and we knew one of the other guys that had gotten drawn. She gave him a big hug because he was everybody's emotions were really high, and another guy from the interior, Jared Dude, he's over in Enderby, Grinrod, he got drawn as well, and so then the business planning takes the next step, and we started researching. We toured barns. We looked all over the place at what we wanted to build and
talk to poultry partners too.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't talk to them originally. Okay. But when we started thinking about the feed mill, like we weren't going to do the nutrition ourselves.
Yeah, for sure.
We needed some guidance there. Mm-hmm. And so Poultry Partners is a nutrition consulting company.
Airdrie, Alberta.
Out of Alberta.
I looked them up.
Yeah. And I had talked to a bunch of different nutritionists in BC trying to find one that would fit with what we wanted to do. And I found the guys in Alberta at Poultry Partners, and they were really interested in what we were doing and the fact that we wanted to use unconventional ingredients and really explore what we could do to...
So they were interested in your breaking new ground, as it were.
Sort of, yeah. And they had more experience. Like in Alberta, they have so much more access to grain and that they had more experience, I felt like. And so that has been a really good fit for us.
But first you had to build your barn.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did that go?
Oh, it was chaos. And then, we found local companies to do most of the work, and we figured out we knew we had to build organic and wanted to build organic. So we built an aviary barn, which at the time was new.
Big Dutchman aviary.
Yeah.
Okay. I immediately started thinking about Dutchman dairy, and then I realized this is not necessarily them.
That's right.
So what is it? What's it like?
It's so if you went into our barn, it's a big open concept. So the birds can't be in cages or anything like that. So they have free access basically between two fences inside the barn. And there's the aviary itself is two towers. And the idea is that it mimics their natural behavior. And so at night they climb up through the system up onto the top and they roost just like a wild bird would feel safe up in a tree.
For sure.
So everybody roosts up on there's not a bird on the floor.
Really?
In the barn.
They must be pretty big towers.
Oh, they're big. They're taller than me.
Yes.
And they're, I think they're 8 feet wide, 10 feet wide on the bottom.
Oh, yeah.
Three different levels. So on each level, on the top level, there's feed and roosting spots. The middle level, there's water and the nest box where they lay their eggs. And then on the bottom level, there's feed and water. And then there's the floor, which is just basically open space on the floor, and they can run around up on the floor and dust bathe. And we've got little enrichment things and peck stones, and we feed free
games
choice
for chickens.
Yeah, it is, and toys and things for them to play with. It sounds silly, but it doesn't sound
silly at all. It doesn't sound silly because, in fact, there's abundant evidence that the quality of the tissues, if you like, in animals of all sorts is improved by them being relaxed and happy. It actually makes a huge difference. It changes their cortisol levels, changes their adrenocortical axis, which is the fight or flight axis. It just calms it right down. And when that happens, blood flow increases. As you can tell, as a physician, I have to deal with this stuff with humans all the time, but it applies to animals too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
And they run outside.
Yeah, they do. I mean, with avian flu, we haven't been able to let them outside because there's so much risk of disease, and it's obviously very bad if we get it. But on a normal year, they are outside for 8 months. around here, and they, so their kind of day starts with, you know, they get up, they feed, they water, they go and lay an egg, they hang out in the barn for a little while, and then as soon as it's warm enough in the afternoon, the doors open, they go out to the pasture, and they can run around till it gets dark.
I'll remind listeners that I'm talking with Mike Schroeder, who is the owner-operator of a wonderful organic farm in the San Bernardino Valley called Lakeland Farms. So here's the chickens. You called them, you had a term for them, mini something or other.
Mini athletes.
Mini athletes.
Yeah.
I think any chicken listening to this program would be delighted to hear that he or she, well, in this case, she was called a mini athlete.
Yeah.
And that's because they're constantly busy.
Oh, they're so busy. And they're so efficient now. The genetics is so efficient, and we know so much about their nutrition and their habits and the rest that they need, the activity that they need, water quality, all kinds of things that they produce so much on so little.
Yes. Yeah. It's the wonderful thing about Mother Nature. She's working 24/7 when we're asleep.
That's right.
Why did you picked a strain called Highline? What was it about that particular strain that appealed?
We've tried a few different breeds. Mm-hmm. We tried a Highline Brown, Lohmann Brown. They each have, they're all, you know, a brown chicken. They produce a similar egg. Mm-hmm. But they all have subtle differences in their behavior and their efficiencies and feed conversion, their suitability to an aviary system versus like a flat floor barn or anything. Lohmanns tend to do better in an aviary setting. They move better throughout the system. They hit their targets more often. They don't, you know, fall and that. But the Highline Brown has been definitely a calmer bird for us. And yeah.
Handle being locked up because of avian flu a little bit better.
Yeah.
So you're producing a pretty substantial number of eggs. How many, like in the full production season, how many eggs would you be producing in a day?
Over a whole year, our a flock will last about a year from beginning to end of production till they're not efficient enough by the end to keep going. Mm. So they produce around, you could say, 340 eggs a year on average for the whole flock.
Each chicken.
Each bird.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're amazingly efficient with what they do.
So you got some insights from poultry partners. You've worked on making sure that what you feed the chickens is what they need, and that's something important. And you also have a lot of chicken manure. And where do you put the chicken manure? Because lots of farms, they produce so much they don't know what to do with it. They put it in settling ponds, but you use it on the land.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we could use another, you know, 20,000 chickens for the amount of land that we farm on for the manure. But we compost it on site, so we take. Mm-hmm. We take a bunch of materials if we can get it. Like this year, we took some stuff from some dairy farms, and we try and make a good compost out of it because it's extremely rich by itself because it's just straight manure. So we try and stabilize that with some other materials that are higher in carbon,
right?
And
diluted a little bit.
Yeah, we keep it for a year. We apply it in the fall, usually trying to get it on cover crops as much as we can. We also blend it with like Spa Hills compost. They take some food waste from town. They also take our birds and compost them at the end of their cycle. Mm-hmm. So we blend it with some of that material to get enough to keep up with our crop needs.
So when a chicken dies, they go into the compost heap.
Yeah, in the interior they do right now for a layer chicken. Mm-hmm. There isn't processing capacity here, but in the lower mainland they're closer to that processing, so in a lot of cases those birds do go for meat.
Yeah. But on the other hand, they don't get discarded, and they become part of the family.
Yeah, absolutely. Family. Yeah.
So you're growing, of course, a lot of feed crops of one sort or another. I copied the list off the website. Brown flax, winter wheat, grass and alfalfa for forage. Fava beans, which we're going to talk about in a moment, buckwheat, barley, and spelt. Now, spelt's interesting. It's not a grain that 15, 20 years ago was as widely understood and widely used. Mm-hmm. What? Why did you bring that into your mix of feed grains and other grains for other purposes?
Yeah, we got a request from Fieldstone Organics in Armstrong. They were looking for somebody to grow spelt, and it was a good fit for our rotation. It's a winter crop, so we can plant it in the fall. It overwinters. We can do a little less tillage than with a spring crop. And we've also started using those fall cereals for seeding clover into. So we frost seed clover in March into an existing crop. In March, the soil is still freezing and thawing. So it pulls that clover seed down. It germinates, but the fall cereal, which would be that case would be spelt, grows past the clover, shades it in, causes it to go dormant. And we take the crop, the spelt off for grain. The clover shoots up through that and turns into this big lush cover crop for the rest of the summer. We're collecting sunlight, feeding microbes in the soil, doing all the good things that cover crops should do.
And what you're talking about is the hands-on management of a farm that involves looking at lots of different parameters that interact and that mm-hmm. intersect. And that's perhaps more a feature with organic farming than with conventional farming.
On average, for sure, because we have to. Yeah. We don't have the tools to deal with pests and disease as easily. You can't flip a switch or spray anything. So we really have to plan. We have to plan for prevention instead of treatment. And so our crop rotation is really, really important to us. We made some horrendous mistakes when we first got into organic farming with that rotation. And so we've tried to add more and more and more diversity to our rotation, more flowering crops, more legume crops. And it's definitely bearing fruit for us in a lot of ways.
So Mike, talking about one of the things that every person who's a farmer learns, I might say everyone who's a doctor learns the same thing, as from my own personal knowledge. You get into a blind alley and it's not working, and you have to change course. So why don't you describe, say, one of the things that you did that you said, oh, this isn't working, and we gotta readjust, we gotta change what we're doing. Why don't you talk about combines?
Yeah. You're talking about the story we talked about last night.
Yes, indeed. This is a story that the world needs to hear, because it's a wonderful example of how you get into a blind alley and you have to backtrack, and then you're good.
Yeah. Yeah, we started in hay. We got into organic grain. We were using custom work. We would hire guys to come in and do the work for us, but it was never timely. And with organics, timing is everything. And so we quickly realized that we needed our own combine. And the combine is, you know, it separates the grain from the stalk of the crop. And so it's this big machine with a million moving parts. It has fans and rotors and a pickup head and all this other stuff. Lots of horsepower. And I had never touched one before, never been exposed to one. So the year we moved here, we started shopping for a combine. We found one in Alberta. We had it shipped out here, got it here, didn't even know how to drive it home from the dealership. And
how did you get it there? On a flatbed?
On a big truck, yeah. They had to pull the tires off because it's too wide and too tall to get it here. So we shipped it in, and I had to drive it home, so the guys had to show me how to drive it at the dealership. So I get it home.
So you drove it down the highway?
We drove back roads from Armstrong.
Yes, back roads.
Yeah, because it's like drivers out it's there. 16 feet wide.
Yes, indeed. You know?
And so we got it back in the, I guess, early spring, did a ton of research that winter and through the spring, messed with the machine, fixed it up, tried to learn as much as possible. So we get into the growing season, crops are doing well. We had a really good growing season, so I had this spelt crop that was huge and rank, and it was like 5.5 feet tall. We got
killer
one of those
crop.
Yeah, one of those big windstorms that comes up the valley during the summer with a bunch of rain, and the whole thing lodged. It all fell over on itself. So it's this big mess of a crop. And so I'd hired a guy to come in and swath the crop. So I said, just do the outside round, just in case I break the combine. I don't want the whole field cut down. And so he swaths the outside round. I drive the combine out to the field, didn't let the crop dry. I'd made, you know, every mistake in the book. and got to the field.
But it was an exciting moment to drive the Littles.
Hugely exciting. and it you know, we're on a busy road. We're on 50th there, southwest, and so everybody drives by. The whole neighborhood, the whole Salmon Valley drives by our place.
Yes, right.
So I was right beside the road. Did my checks around the machine. The guy in the swather comes walking over and he said, "Hey, you know, I've been in a combine a few times. You want me to come with you?" And I said, "Oh, that'd be great." So we jump in the combine and I fire the thing up and it's, you know, everything's moving, big, loud machine. And I edge into the crop just a little bit and I pull just a little bit of spelt in and it goes through the machine and it spits out a little bit of grain. I was like, "Oh,
we're here.
It worked. We're here." Yeah. So I go a little more. Little more. And the guy looks at me, he says, "Don't be such a chicken, get in there." So I roll into the crop with, you know, continuous flow, and I suck in this big wad of wet, nasty spelt, and it goes wham! And it plugs the combine, plugs it full. And so when you plug a combine, you got to take the whole guts apart and drop the concaves and pull all this stuff out by hand. And it's hours and hours and hours of work. And the guy's wife pulls up to pick him up after he's finished swathing. He looks at me and says, "Well, my wife's here. I got to run. See you later." So I'm sitting there beside the road, you know, all night long with this combine. And I, you know, limped it home at midnight.
Waving at the neighbors as they drove by.
Yeah, everybody's laughing. So we did get that crop off. We learned a lot of lessons the first year with the combine. So
the fact is that on a farm, you don't have the option of saying, "Well, we'll just go down to the corner store and buy a new one," or you know, have somebody come in from, you know, the store next door to fix it for us. You have to do it yourself.
Yeah.
So you spent a long night.
Yeah.
And in the end, you knew what to do with this, with the combine from there on.
Well, we learn stuff every year with that machine, and it's a good community though too. Like, and we've had a lot of help, you know, local neighbors when we have been in a pinch have come and helped us out with crops and combine this or that, and we've helped them out too. We've got a really good community that way, but we learned some hard lessons with that machine. We broke a lot of stuff.
Well, let's talk about something where you've really done some very interesting work, and it's catching on with other people, and that's putting in a cover crop that other people don't use, the fava beans. They're called fava beans.
Yeah.
They're called fava beans. So if anybody's listening, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Fava with a B or fava with a V.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, they're very interesting crop, and you've had some very interesting experiences with them.
Yeah, we needed a legume in our rotation, more than just alfalfa. So we wanted a leguminous grain crop because they suck nitrogen out of the air and they leave it in the soil, and nitrogen is a very valuable fertilizer.
Sure.
They also provide a disease break from something that's completely unrelated, which is still important to us, like wheat or something. So we tried peas originally, because that's a really common grain crop legume. But they're a viney plant. They tend to lodge really bad around here, and then they shatter. So the pods actually, when they get dry, they open up and they'll fall out before you can harvest them. So we didn't have very good experiences with peas, and we were really stuck. And a friend of mine in Saskatchewan that I had gone to school with said, "Hey, why don't you try fava beans or have a look at them?" And so I looked into it, and you know, they're a moisture loving crop. They're less prone to lodge, disease stuff is the same and similar. And, so we thought we'd try them. So we
and
did
lots of nitrogen,
lots of nitrogen. And lots of protein too. So we use them in cover crops, but mostly as a cash crop. And, so the peas or the beans, sorry, are typically like 28 to 32% protein, whereas a pea would be 20, maybe 22. So there's a really good advantage there protein-wise as a feed product or food. And they also fix an amazing amount of nitrogen, like not as much as a multi-year alfalfa crop, but pretty darn close.
And compared to soy, how do they come in?
They're lower in protein than like a soy meal, which is a very concentrated source of protein. But they allow us to, if we have that in the ration, we can cut a bunch of soy, which is typically like an imported product. It's hard to grow around here.
Yeah.
So we can cut a lot of that out of our ration. It helps a lot.
Sure.
Yeah. So they've been a really good fit, but it was really funny. Like, we did, you know, we did a couple of test plots for a couple of years of, you know, 2 or 3 acres to try and get the hang of it. And now we're up to, like, last year we did 55, I think. Hmm. But nobody knows what they are around here. Nobody's seen them. So during the summer, anybody that, so we get visitors into the yard all the time. They'll just pull into the yard and they'll come up and, what is that crop standing out there? And so it's really interesting. And they're really fragrant too.
I was going to say, they smell pretty.
Oh man. If you drive by the field when it's flowering, it sounds like or smells like the inside of a flower greenhouse. Like it's just amazingly fragrant. Yeah. And the pollinators love it. Like the wild bumblebees and stuff that come into that field, you could just sit inside the crop and watch them. It's amazing.
Let's talk about pollinators a little bit, because there's a bit of a fixation with the European honeybee, but there are a very large number of species of different kinds of pollinators that, if they get the right terrain, the right food to consume, they really flourish.
Yeah.
And you're seeing a lot of pollinators in your property.
Yeah. And we've started using, last year was the first year we did like a true pollinator strip, and that was really interesting. We have a fellow, Martin DeHoog, that grows, that has bees in the valley. So he put a bunch of his hives on our place, and we put a pollinator strip right beside his hives, and plus the flowering crops that we grow, and they love it. And I mean, the pollinators are great to see, and the wild stuff that comes off the mountain and that is great to see. But it also helps us with a lot of predatory insects that helps us in the rest of the crops, like lady beetles, ladybugs, mm-hmm. for aphids and so on. That diversity in the crop, one next to the other, really helps with that pest pressure.
That seems to be that's people talk about eco-agriculture, and the fact that you incorporate elements from the wild ecosystem into what you're growing as a sort of a food crop. And it sounds like that's part of what this is all about too, that you're fostering the development of pollinators that would otherwise, you know, they'd have to look a lot further afield, but you're giving them a massive spread, a smorgasbord.
Yeah.
A pollinator smorgasbord. Let's talk a little bit, we're coming close to the end of the show. Let's talk a little bit about the inclusion of animals in farming, not just organic farming, but just having animals on the property. You have a few beef cattle, not many, and you have a lot of chickens, and they all produce manure, but they also, it seems to be an important dimension. We talked yesterday about the work of Alan Savory in East Africa, where he's demonstrated clearly that having massive inclusion of animals in landscape regeneration can be a real step forward. And you found that too.
Yeah, absolutely. We have one piece of the property that's not, it's not a great cash crop spot. It's kind of up on the hillside of Mount Ida, and it's got springs on it in the springtime and makes it really difficult to produce crops on. So every year we buy a handful of beef, a dozen steers in the spring, and we sell them in the fall or process them in the fall. And so we've been experimenting with rotational grazing, because I see that's probably the future of some of our crop rotation, utilizing more of the cover crops, right. and having an animal impact. But it's, you can definitely see the benefit in that pasture. Like, it used to be cut for hay every year, you know, year in, year out. And now we're trampling and returning a lot of residue and a lot of manure to that field. Mm-hmm. So the first year that we did it, you know, you'd see a cow patty and it'd just sit there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And this past year, I could show you some really neat videos of like dung beetles burrowing through these cow patties.
Having so with within hell of a good time,
yeah, and then they're tunneling down into the soil, and like the biodiversity, yeah. just within 3 short years is flourishing in that field.
It's said that in Africa, an elephant patty would be useless if there weren't dung beetles that spread mm-hmm. it out over sometimes several acres, one chunk of droppings. Soil, just close with a brief comment about soil and how important is now is the soil on your property getting to where you want it to be?
It's getting closer. I mean, it's going to be a long work in progress. We were starting from a very low point in organic matter, and but it is obviously improving, and we've been doing a lot of testing, and I have a lot to learn, but we've been doing some really targeted nutrient applications, and it's definitely showing up.
Mike, it's really been a delight to have you on the show today. Mike Schroeder from Lakeland Farms. I think you've really given a pretty clear snapshot of what it's like to be a farmer's son and then come onto a farm and have a farm of your own. It's a wonderful story, and thank you for sharing it with us today.
Thanks for the discussion.